Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Governor Andrew Cuomo says some upstate regions may be able to have a limited reopening of some businesses when the current shutdown order expires for the state May 15th, but it will come with many caveats. He says no region is ready to reopen right now. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt with the latest.
Cuomo says several regions of the state have had a lower rate of the virus than the hot spots of downstate and more transmission rates in Buffalo and the Albany area. The governor is setting a list of criteria for potential regional reopenings in the Rochester area, where he held his briefing, as well as the North Country, the Mohawk Valley, Central New York, and the Southern Tier. He says it's all based on epidemiological science, and it aims for holding the transmission rate of the virus to 1.1% or lower, so that the greater freedom of movement does not lead to the virus multiplying exponentially and causing another health crisis. He says New York is trying to learn from other countries like Italy and Singapore, where an initial reopening occurred too quickly and restarted spread of the disease.
You'd rather have a controlled start so you don't have to stop, right? And that's what you learn from the other countries. You reopen too fast, then you have to stop.
Regions that qualify for a limited reopening will first have to see the rate of infection decline for 14 days in a row. That's in accordance with CDC guidelines. In regions that have seen few cases so far, there needs to be less than 15 new cases and less than 5 new deaths in a 3-day rolling average. And there has to be fewer than 2 new COVID patients admitted to the hospital each day for every 100,000 residents. Also, there needs to be an adequate number of hospitals, and 30% of all hospital beds must be kept empty in case the virus resurges. All hospitals also need to have a 90-day supply of PPE, masks and gloves, at an amount to meet the highest level of COVID infections that a region experienced at its highest point so far. And there also needs to be enough testing, with the capability to provide 30 tests for every 100,000 residents, along with adequate contact tracing. Cuomo says meeting those goals for reopening will depend on local government officials and healthcare administrators working together.
Putting all of these new systems in place is an incredible task.
So far, the lack of adequate testing is the biggest obstacle for many of the regions to reopen. The reopenings, when they do occur, will be limited and happen in phases. The first businesses that can reopen are manufacturing and construction firms who can demonstrate that they can operate their businesses with social distancing and have enough masks and other protective gear for their employees. Also in that first phase, retail businesses that can limit sales to curbside pickup. The second phase includes professional services, retail stores, real estate, and rental leasing offices. The third phase would allow restaurants and hotels to reopen. And finally, if all of those reopenings do not lead to an increase in the spread of the virus, then concerts and art museums and schools could reopen. The governor says it won't be easy, and much will depend on the cooperation of individual New Yorkers.
By wearing the mask, by maintaining the social distancing, that's how we get through this. Everybody has a role to play here. There is no pointing fingers. Nobody's been here before. It's no one else's job. It's all of us together. And that's what has worked so well so far.
Cuomo says everyone should be wearing masks and practicing social distancing. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok.
Well, some big news. Alan, a federal judge says the New York Democratic presidential primary must take place June 23rd because canceling it would be unconstitutional. There is an appeal.
Well, yeah, you know, this is a tough one. The state Democratic Party probably with the influence of the governor, says that we're going to postpone the primary out of an abundance of caution and we don't want people infecting each other. Yes, there's a point there. On the other hand, it happened in Wisconsin. People stood in line. This is one of our most cherished rights, and we're going to do it. I think this move on the part of the Board of Elections was a bad move, because sooner or later we're going to get to the presidential election itself. And I don't like precedents where elections are called off, because we know that this president, who is suffering and his credibility declines, will certainly be tempted to call off the federal election, despite what the Constitution says about the need for this and every other law. That's when totalitarianism takes over. So, yeah, I didn't like it when they did it. I understand it. I know the caution that is taken, but it just sets a very bad precedent.
Well, he had a very interesting discussion with Blair Horner, the head of NYPERG.
What a great man.
Really, really intelligent when it comes to understanding the legislative process and what's going on. But you guys got to talking about what the governor is going to do if or if he doesn't get the federal money that he's counting on, with the state so badly in debt, now projecting 15, maybe 20 billion or more. And up came the idea of the stock transfer tax. Blair says the governor should turn it on. It would raise $15 billion right off the top off stock speculators. And he says it's a good idea, and that Capital Region Assemblyman Phil Steck has a bill on this. And it was quite an interesting discussion as to, you know, where are we going to get this money?
Well, that's right. There are a couple of choices here. Number one, you can just wreck the services that we have in this state. For example, education. If you have a 20 or 25% cut, because usually you have some extra aid every year, if you have a huge cut, a lot of people are going to get fired. A lot of teachers are going to be out of there. Administrators will be out of there. Students will be suffering. It'll be awful. Now, both Blair Horner and I agree on one thing, and that is even this draconian president is going to have to do something about the states, and will. But he and his able lieutenant, Mitch McConnell, will, the Senate leader, we'll come up with something that they will get in return for it. We don't exactly know what that's going to be, but you better believe there's going to be a negotiating process in which, in order for the states to get something, Trump will have to win something.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. In a typical year, New York State lawmakers would be entering the last few weeks of the legislative session, with the state budget already finished, but the so-called Big Ugly still looming. This year has been anything but typical. But one New York State senator said he expects to be back in Albany in the next week or two, though there has been no formal announcement. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn spoke with first-term state senator Pete Harkham about this and other COVID impacts.
State lawmakers have been working remotely. As for returning to Albany...
Well, we may, you know, and I don't know that we will all physically go back. We now have the ability to vote remotely. I think it's important that some of us go back just to show that we... You know, the government is open, the government is working, taking care of the people's business. But we may be back. We certainly have to handle the budget issues within the next week or two. We need to get started on that. And there are certain areas with the coronavirus where there are packages of bills looking to help consumers, small businesses, things like that, that hopefully we can take up in conjunction with the assembly. You know, there are discussions that we will be going back there, but there is no date certain for when we will be back.
Harkham represents the 40th district, which includes parts of Westchester, Putnam, and Dutchess counties.
Right now, the prime concern is making sure that the state is doing everything it can to get the unemployment website accurate, make sure everybody gets a call back who was in the backlog. The pandemic unemployment insurance, which is a federal component, that was really where the remaining backlog was. So a number of us have been in the Senate and in the Assembly have been working with the governor's office. You know, they seem to be clearing through the backlog, but, you know, our phone keeps ringing. You know, people are hurting, whether it's unemployment insurance, small business claims, and now we're getting a lot of calls about food insecurity. You know, people who maybe used to donate to a food pantry are now clients.
Though mentioned, Harcum does not represent Ossining.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Municipal governments in New York have some difficult decisions to make, with revenues falling short during the pandemic. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas with that story.
The pandemic has impacted municipal finances. In Albany, two of the biggest warm weather attractions, the Tulip Festival and the Fryhofer's Run for Women, were canceled. Officials are hopeful restrictions will be eased upstate, but the clock is ticking. Albany Common Council President Corey Ellis says the panel has met with Mayor Kathy Sheehan about where city finances stand.
Our cash flow situation is good. We look at possibly June run out of cash if things stay the same. But as far as that, you know, our city council members have sent a letter to D.C. and also the mayor signed on to the letter looking at possible revenue streams as far as looking at supporting another stimulus package, so that cities and counties in the state don't have to go through these drastic cuts of having to lay off firefighters and police officers, public safety that we desperately, desperately need at this time. But at this time, we you know, our mayor hasn't brought up looking at that yet. We are looking at in departments right now to see where we can save while we're doing, you know, while we're in this quarantine stage. But I'm pretty sure everything is uncertain.
Mayor Sheehan says tough decisions loom any day.
We are all losing, you know, across the country, billions and billions of dollars in revenue. And if we do not have that revenue, we cannot pay our employees. And if we cannot pay our employees, we cannot provide essential city services.
In Schenectady, the city council meets tonight after the Daily Gazette reported Friday that the electric city is at the edge of a financial cliff. Democratic Mayor Gary McCarthy is reportedly looking at $3 million in cuts, including 30 police officers. The news caught Councilman John Mudavaran by surprise.
The council was not aware of this proposed cut by the mayor, and it's unfortunately that we heard about it via the newspaper.
Councilwoman Lisa Perrazzo.
Now is not the time to cut emergency services for the residents of our city, who are already feeling vulnerable considering the state of affairs we are in. I think there are many different scenarios we can look at budgetarily to help fill this gap if need be. We have a robust general fund that we can look to use some of. We could look at getting our police overtime under control. We can look at furloughing some non-essential City Hall or Parks staff, especially with the additional federal dollars coming in right now that dovetail with unemployment. There are many, many, many scenarios that we can look at budgetarily.
Mudavaran says the council will address the issue tonight.
I have it on the agenda as an item to be discussed at our committee meeting. We will discuss more and then get to the bottom of it and able to see what the council can do to help to navigate this.
Neither the mayor nor police chief responded to requests for comment. Back in Albany, Ellis outlines tonight's agenda.
We have a couple resolutions that we're looking at passing in support of. One resolution is in support of a superheroes project that Senator Chuck Schumer has introduced into part of the legislation. So we got a council member who's going to be introducing that resolution, and we're going to be showing support for that. So we'll be passing that. And we also, council members, are looking at passing a resolution in regards to the food shortage supplies that we see when it comes to food manufacturing.
Most municipal meetings have gone online during the pandemic.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government, politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us on the Legislative Gazette this week is Robert Kammer. Well, let me explain. While the novel coronavirus outbreak has forced many New Yorkers to do their jobs from home, even most essential workers commute from home to work and back, including myself. A small number of essential workers, however, are doing the opposite, living at their work site. One of those workers is joining us today, as just mentioned, Robert Kammer. He is a shift supervisor for Blenheim Gilboa Power Project. That's in Gilboa, New York, about 60 miles from the capital, Albany. Hello, Robert.
Good morning, David.
Well, coming in from the outside world, something you haven't seen for a bit of time, but I understand that you and your colleagues are on rotating shifts.
Yes, sir. Normally, I am a shift worker. That is my role here. But we work 12-hour shifts, but normally I go home, come back to work the next day. But currently, over the past 5 weeks or so, we have been in a sequester-in-place procedure. So now we do our 12-hour shift, and then we stay at work and go to our camp and, you know, recreation, stuff like that, go to sleep, and then come back to work.
Well, I want to get into some of the specifics here. But first, let's just remind people that this is all part of a complex to help keep the lights on in New York. So part of the New York Power Authority, your Blenheim Gilboa Pumped Storage Power Project is kind of like a big battery. You're storing large amounts of electricity, correct?
Yes, sir. Basically, the way it works here is we have an upper reservoir and a lower reservoir. And the lower reservoir is right on the Schoharie Creek in the Blenheim Gilboa area. And so the way it works, it's designed as basically a closed loop system. We move water between the upper and lower reservoir. When we move it from the upper reservoir down to the lower reservoir, we use the difference in height, which is about 1,000 feet, to rotate our large generating units and produce power for the grid. And during off-peak hours or when needed, we take that same water that we use to make power, and we spin the units in the opposite direction, and they act as pumps, and they take that water, and then they pump it back to the upper reservoir to be used again the next day, the next week, whenever it's needed. So we are, as you said, a pump storage project, power project, and use us for, you know, emergencies, insurance, you know, peak shaving on high prices. So it's an interesting setup.
Yeah, it certainly is. And Robert, I imagine too that during the summertime, which we're about to head into at those peak periods, right, when everybody's got the air conditioning on in New York City and everywhere else.
Yes, sir. So, you know, our optimal times of year for operating is in the middle of the summer, the three summer months, and basically the middle of the winter, you know. So the impact of our plant is for extreme hot or extreme cold temperatures. So as of right now, we're just rolling out of what we call the shoulder months, where, you know, temperatures are a little more mild and we don't get in the game quite as often. But we're always here for emergency purposes.
Yeah, essentially a backup system in many ways, right? So that people probably don't think about this a lot, but you've been doing what most people are doing now in a pandemic. For years, you're prepared for that because there could be an emergency in which you're needed. And I understand that even your facilities, while it may not be as cozy as a hotel room, you have processes and equipment and other things in place so that you can spend a week or two in the building.
Oh, absolutely. I believe NYPA has been preparing for this in one way or another for many years. And I remember, you know, having the pandemic freezer show up and, you know, stocked with food that has a long shelf life, or MREs that the military would use, you know, for just in case it ever came on as quick. But for this one, the good news about it was kind of foreseen and there was planning going into it. So you kind of knew, like, hey, I'm going to be going to work and I'm going to be staying there for maybe 2 weeks, maybe 4 weeks. But yes, you know, even without that planning, you know, we had procedures in place.
So, you know, there's got to be a lot of hang around and wait time while this is going on. And you guys, you know, at these various facilities, can you communicate with each other? Is there anything you can do video-wise? What do you do when you're alone? How do you pass the time?
Well, as I said, with a 12-hour shift, there's not as much downtime as you would expect comparative to working an 8-hour shift. And most of us here are used to working 12-hour shifts. So you don't have quite as many hours that you have to figure out what to do with. So kind of our routine here for the past few weeks is we get done, you know, we go down to our camp, which is basically an office building, and each of us kind of have our own rooms where we have beds and things in there and our personal things. And whether we have dinner or, you know, NYPA has provided several forms of entertainment if we want, you know, a video game system, board games.
I heard cornhole.
Yes, yes, sir. Cornhole.
Nice.
is there as well. So that's the one that it's not together yet. So obviously people have, you know, other things to do, but everybody says, oh, yeah, we got to get going with that. We got to get going with that. But, you know, nowadays with the technology the way it is, there's a Wi-Fi connection they set up for us down there. So anybody with a Netflix account or any other streaming account, it's probably almost like being at home, just not quite seeing your family. And even that, you FaceTime them when needed.
And do you do it with each other? Do you have meetings where you're – I heard during the Easter holiday that some were drawing Easter bunnies and coloring eggs.
Oh, could be. Could be. That sounds like that could be happening between the between the shifts on site. You know, you – like anything, when you find yourself kind of in isolated circumstances like that, you know, there are things like that you do to kind of pass the time that otherwise you normally wouldn't. But that's kind of the camaraderie that builds in these cases.
Did you volunteer to be sequestered?
Yes, sir. I was asked. I'm part of the second group here at BG. The first two groups of individuals, you know, night shift and day shift, they ended up sequestering in place for 4 weeks. And to relieve them, or prior to relieving them, when we were looking for the next round of people, there's an order they follow. And then I got a phone call and said, hey, would you like to be a part of this? And I said, certainly. You know, it may not have seemed like part of the job, but it is part of the job, you know, that we do here, you know, working in a hydro power facility. You know, this needs to be manned all the time.
Sure. Give us an idea of why that is. I'm sure a lot of it has to do with it could be a dangerous situation if you aren't monitoring levels and doing what you need to do to generate that power.
Oh, absolutely. So here at BG, it's, you know, it's not a standard just transmission or just generation. You know, we do a lot of, you know, several different things. You know, some people are set up where, you know, I handle bulk power transmission or distribution level transmission or just generation. Here at BG, we have four large pump storage units or pump generator units. And those four units, as I said, are quite large, and they're capable of putting almost 1,200 megawatts out onto the grid, which, I mean, without knowing the specifics, I mean, trust me when I say that's a large amount of power that can all come from this facility when needed. But the other things we do here, we have several other, we call them like run-of-the-river plants, smaller units located up on the Mohawk River in the Crescent Vischer Ferry area, Clifton Park and that area, sure. And then some more units out on the Hinckley Reservoir in Utica and the Ashokan Reservoir down in Shokan. So we remotely monitor those units, control, you know, so the operators here are on off with these units and monitoring them. And plus they're constantly, you know, watching water levels, making sure, you know, we're watching those plants as well. So that's the generation, you know, transmission assets. We have three bulk power through 345 kV lines here at our switchyard in Gilboa. And then other transmission facilities that we, you know, monitor from here. We remotely monitor the Marcy switchyard, which is up in Utica. And we also remotely monitor some series caps, the first of their kind in New York State, that are in the Fraser Annex area, as well as a gas-insulated substation system that's down in the Middletown area. So that's kind of where our transmissions assets fall into play, what the guys are watching, you know, maintaining eyes on. And then the other big thing for us is water. You know, we control, you know, not control, but we're stewards for the flow of water here at the Schoharie Creek. We sit just downstream of the New York City DEP's Gilboa Dam and their reservoir, and we have our own dam and reservoir. But, you know, with the lower reservoir and the dam, you know, we control the outflow. So, and typically we run it as whatever comes in goes out. But those are manual changes that we do to, you know, pass water through the facility. So,
are you monitoring all of this? What do you specifically do? So, for example, are you the one pushing the button to lower or raise the water level? I mean, how does that work out with the various employees that are there?
So for all the stuff I explained, that's done by the operators. And
you're
so
an operator. Are you an operator?
I am the operations supervisor.
Okay.
So I don't get to push the buttons anymore. I just get to say, hey, we're going to push that button, right? And they say, yes, we are just about to push it or we have already pushed it, you know.
You take the wider view. You're monitoring the whole process.
Yes. So, you know, the role of the shift supervisor here, which, I mean, it can be, you know, I mean, he can be involved in many different things. NYPA has always been very good about creating the kind of workforce that does a lot of different things. So, but here, you know, as the shift supervisor, you're kind of involved in the scheduling and the overview of the day-to-day operations. But a lot of different things you do with paperwork, procedure writing, preventative maintenance scheduling, and making sure that gets done. So you don't ever get bored doing the same thing over and over because, I mean, the amount of different things that we can be involved in is truly what makes, you know, one of the best features about this position.
His name is Robert Kammer, shift supervisor at the Blenheim Gilboa, BG, that is, Pump Storage Power Project, in Gilboa, New York. Fascinating to discuss with him what he does, how it works, and the fact that they, as essential workers, have been sequestered at work. Imagine having to sleep at work every night and not see your family. Well, Robert, maybe your military experience helped you, but that would make me a little bit crazy.
Yeah, well, I think it did help me too, but it's, like I said, it's been good. NYPA's really provided everything we could ask for so far in this, so thank you.
That was Robert Kammer, a shift supervisor at the Glenham Gilboa Power Project, part of the New York Power Authority. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2019. Or just listen to our podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.